This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, welcome to On Telecast, Season 5, Episode 11. How you doing, Brian?
I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm all right. Good episode today. We have a guest. Haven't had a guest in a while that, or more of a traditional guest, I guess.
Right, traditional guest.
Yeah. On today is Chris Whitaker. He works at Explorer Research. He's a partner there. He's going to talk about shopper research. And, you know, we recorded the interview yesterday, and you know, we've talked about shopper research and stuff and their capabilities a lot, and they certainly Explorer Research is amazing. What I love, though, was kind of a conversation around trends.
Yeah.
Shopping, right?
Yeah, he is super knowledgeable about that and kind of what they've seen over the last couple years. We talk about what is more of a permanent trend versus a temporary trend and different impacts of that way on how – different impacts, one, on how research is going to be done for shopper insights – with the changes in shopper behavior.
Right. So really interesting discussion. I could have gone a long time with him in this interview talking just about trends and what's changing with shopper behavior, which is really kind of fascinating. So I think it's worth a listen. And with no further ado, here is Chris from Explorer Research.
Joining me now, I have Chris Whitaker. He's a partner at Explorer Research. Chris, hey, how are you, sir? How you doing?
I am great, Brian. Thanks. Hopefully you're doing well as well as we get into the second half of March here. And it's nice to see the beautiful weather coming back.
Yeah, and you're in Canada, is that correct?
Actually, today I'm in Florida. Typically I spend my time between Chicago and Toronto in my capacity as managing our shopper lab facilities and as a partner Explorer Research. But I'm here temporarily, and I will be actually flying back tomorrow.
Okay, not a bad place to be. As we, I guess in Canada, you're ending winter a little bit behind most of us in the U.S.
Yeah, we've seen a dramatic change. I mean, obviously, it's been a very, very cold winter, a very snowy winter, much more so than we're used to. And don't know if that's a sign of things to come in the years moving forward, or if that's just a one-year anomaly, but after many, many years of milder winters, this was certainly, a very, very hard winter.
Yeah, we were too, for sure. So I'd love to hear about your background and kind of what you do now at Explorer Research.
Yeah, at Explorer Research, let's start with it. I joined Explorer 12 years ago when we were in our infancy. And essentially, at the time, there were three of us who started the company. And we had a background of all working together in the packaged goods industry. We were had all worked together at Kraft General Foods. Prior to that, I left Kraft General Foods and went off to work in the agency business for a number of years. And my other two partners, Mark Inkle and Ann Stevenson, got together and we came back together, if you will, the three of us, to form a company called Explorer Shopper Research, since changed to Explorer Research. But our backgrounds are all packaged goods, CPG, major company CPG. So that was our sort of initial point of difference. And the company has grown dramatically since then to what it is today with the two offices, two different shopper labs, both in the US and in Canada, and a large clientele of CPG and retail clients.
Okay. And yeah, maybe tell me more about Explorer Research, the shopper insights. What do you kind of focus on?
We focus on being shopper. We call ourselves shopper experts. Obviously, as I alluded to between our different backgrounds, we have a lot of client side experience. We've obviously grown the company and supplemented it with a lot of different experts in different areas. We focus on shopper research, and we really try to focus on the behavioral side of that too. So It's not just enough to interview respondents in terms of what they think about things. It's really the added value of using behavioral techniques, whether that's eye tracking or GSR, to really get a sense for, you know, what they're doing and they're not telling you about. So it's that combination of what they tell you and what we can monitor from what they're doing that allows us to come forward with some great insights. And we focus on, you know, packaging optimization. We focus on path to purchase in terms of the purchase cycle for products. We do a lot of planogram optimization work with our CPG clients and our retailers. And that's particularly important now in the post-COVID world where obviously there's less selection in stores and things have been moved around. So having that correct planogram and having that right package in front of a consumer to be able to make a choice is critical. And we also do a lot of e-com testing and usability testing. And we are full service. So we have a full quantitative and a full qualitative capabilities and experts in both of those areas to be able to get it behavioral.
Okay, good. And you do shopper labs, right? Can you explain what a shopper lab is? I see on your website kind of what it is.
When we started out, and as I mentioned 12 years ago, when we started out, we really saw a point of difference by developing a shopper lab. And in its rudimentary form, a shopper lab was a large open space where we obviously brought in shelving, whether that's grocery or drugstore or mass merchandiser related. We're able to stock those shelves, arguably with real products, or use representative high definition skins. And we can allow people, respondents, to come in and shop that those shelves. As we've developed that further over the last 8 to 10 years, for sure, we have now in Chicago, for example, a 5,000 square foot shopper lab with multiple aisles, checkouts. We have a dedicated VR area in that lab as well. So we're actually able to bring in respondents, have them shop for products, have them be eye tracked. All of this being observed either by the client who's on site or now remotely, obviously via the internet, and we can let them shop those sections unencumbered. And then once they're completed that shopping, we can then ask questions and really get to the root of what decision-making process they went through. And again, as I said, in combination with that, we overlay particularly the eye tracking side of it, which allows us to know exactly, you know, what did they pay attention to? What signs did they notice? What packages stood out? What did they totally ignore? And, you know, most clients are amazed at the fact that they've done a lot of work on a package and yet it doesn't even get noticed by the respondent. So part of our objective in that optimization process is to, you know, give them optimization ideas to make sure their package does stand out or to make sure that the planogram that they're using with a retailer is optimized for that particular category.
Right. And I'm really impressed. You mentioned it was 5,000 square feet.
Yes.
Multiple aisles. That's really large. And I know you're trying to get to as close to the environment to an actual shopping experience. And I went to Trader Joe's 45 minutes ago.
Yeah.
5,000 square feet is not that much smaller than an actual Trader Joe's, for example, right? You can really kind of emulate what a shopper goes through.
Yeah, we've tried to keep it as, you know, one of the ideas too is to keep it as absolutely flexible as possible. So for example, you know, we're not trying to duplicate a full store because obviously that's a little larger than life and you don't really need to. So typically we're interested in, you know, let's say one aisle or the checkout experience, the queuing experience when you're coming up to the checkout, you know, what you're doing, what you're looking at, what you're paying attention to. But the space is, as I say, flexible. We can move those shelves anywhere we want to. We could put a fast food outlet in that space if we wanted to. If we want to, you know, put in a Starbucks store, for example, that could all fit in there and we could deck it out to look exactly like a Starbucks or any other client needs that we're trying to duplicate. And that then allows us to have full control over the environment. So unlike doing it in a store where obviously you're trying to stay out of the way of the shoppers that are in the store. And in many stores, you're not allowed to actually move things around or touch the shelves. In our case, obviously we have total control over that. So as I mentioned before, we can do that with real products. And we can stock the shelves with real products. We have what we call skins, which are high definition skins, which are two dimensional, where we actually go in and photograph a store or the sections of a store, put those on life size vinyl skins and actually hang them on the shelf. So when you look down the aisle, It looks like a store. The only difference being you can't physically pull the individual products off the shelf. But that works for some kinds of testing. It also works very well if you're trying to have a background. So in other words, if you've got real products in one section and you want to make sure the rest of it looks like the balance of the store, we can use skins that look very real to dress up the rest of the store. And in combination with that, as I mentioned before, we have a dedicated virtual reality space within our lab as well. So we can conduct VR testing again for all these things I've talked about: environment, retail space, displays, planograms, by putting consumers in a VR headset and having them run through a three-dimensional face-to-face shopping experience. So we try to be fully inclusive, if you will, of all the different types of methodologies we can use. We also do immersive testing. And immersive testing can either put one of those shoppers in a retail environment and then we're able to ask them questions online while they're in that environment, or we can put them in our lab, be able to move things around and change things, and then also do that as a fully immersive interview or focus group type exercise.
That sounds really cool. One thing, I'm guessing that you were impacted like the rest of us with COVID, right? And so you probably had some challenges with getting people in, and you're probably not doing a lot of base sizes. You're not trying to crowd the shopper aisles, but I'm assuming this affected you and you had to pivot a little bit, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we've all had a challenging time during the pandemic, no question. Obviously, there was a period of time for both of our shopper labs where we had to close them temporarily because of the regulations that were in place for those locations. And when we were able to reopen them, we had to, like everybody else, we had to implement a number of very stringent regulations and protocols to both pre-screen respondents coming into the lab and to make sure that when they were there, they were applying social distancing, that they were wearing masks, that they had obviously the ability to cleanse all of the equipment that was being used, et cetera. So that's obviously now starting to open up a little bit. We're fortunate in the sense, as I mentioned, that a lot of the types of things we do, we could also do online. So we do VR testing online, for example, and we do a lot of planogram studies that way. We can do fully immersive qualitative testing online. So we were able to keep going and conduct business. We just weren't able to do as much face-to-face. And the other side of the business where we've had great success over the years is what I'll call face-to-face at retail. And in face-to-face at retail, what we do is obviously working with either the retailer as a partner or a CPG company through the retailer is conduct in-store interviews, in-store observations, you know, watching how people shop in a section and not talking to them, for example, or having pre-arranged interviews or intercept interviews, as we call them, in a retail environment, saying, hey, can we ask you a few questions while you're shopping for this category, pre-screen them and have an interview right while they're there. So those were obviously very much affected by COVID as well, because some of the retailers were closed depending on the geography. And also on top of that, you know, they were very concerned about social distancing and only having a select number of people in a store at a time. So really didn't necessarily want the interruption. So I'm happy to report that has now changed again and opened up again, depending on the geography. We're conducting studies again in retail stores, both observations and interviews. And we're also conducting studies in multiple locations across the U.S. where it relates to projects where clients want a different sense of how different geographies in the U.S. might affect the particular test.
Okay. You've been doing this a while and you've been tracking trends in the industry. I'm curious, what's happened over the past couple of years? Have we seen a massive shift in behavior? Are people shopping differently? Maybe from your perspective, I'd love to hear a couple of like trends that you're seeing in terms of shopping.
Yeah, I mean the most obvious one, and I think we're all doing it, is we're buying a lot more of the goods that we get day to day online, and obviously we saw that very early in the pandemic, where because you couldn't go to as many stores, or because people were concerned about leaving their homes or couldn't leave their homes, that they were able to then shift to online buying, and across just about every category. So the biggest trend, obviously the most obvious one, is now that people are more used to shopping online, that's going to stay with us. I think it will not grow as quickly as it has over the last 2 years, obviously, moving forward. But again, if you think about what consumers are really looking for in most categories, we're looking for convenience, we're looking for price. And, you know, if you can buy things online from Amazon or from Walmart and essentially get them delivered the same day or maybe one day later, that's very convenient. And typically the pricing is very good as well. So that's definitely the biggest trend that we're seeing. I think the other thing too, even for traditional what we'll call brick and mortar retailers, we're seeing a lot more formats, and of which click and collect would be one, for example. So in click and collect, you're able to go online and place your order, the click part, and then the collect part is you go to the Walmart parking lot and you pick up your products. And you don't have to go in the store. You really don't even have to get out of your car. So that, in combination with a lot of the, you know, what we've seen in terms of payment options, you know, by using your credit card online, by using Apple Pay, by using all of the PayPal, by all the myriad of payment options that are now available, the convenience side has come to the forefront, if you will, in terms of how we go shopping. So that's made a big difference as well. When you look at the actual retail environment, you think about the way we all used to shop for, you know, traditional items in the past, call it grocery or drug or mass merchandiser type items. I mean, the behaviors that we're seeing now, even though stores are typically fully open now, we're seeing less browsing. We're seeing less impulse purchases because arguably people are still interested. They'll go into a store now. They don't have to wear a mask anymore, which is a good thing. But there's still a concern that I may not want to spend any more time in there than I have to. So that old shopping trip that used to take 30 minutes in a grocery store, you know, we're finding at least for now that has been quickened. The pace is quickened. I'm not shopping as many of those aisles. I'm not shopping as for long. And that cuts down on my ability to purchase items on impulse. You're seeing stores now having to really change the way they look at checkout sections, for example. Whereas before, we saw a lot of items that were sort of grab and go items that were right there at the checkout. You'd pick them up as you're waiting in line to cash out. Well, guess what? That's changed a little bit because people are now further apart typically when they are checking out, and you know they're not as interested or not as accessible to buy some of those items at the checkout. So we're having to work with clients now to rethink how those impulse items in particular at the front end are racked, where they're merchandised, and what the best way to keep them moving. The other thing too. What's that?
Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Sure,
A quick follow-up? No, you're great. I have so many questions on everything. I know Brian has one too. The grocery delivery and especially the, I'm not sure what you called it, but when you
click to collect,
I'm curious how much of a long-term trend that is. And do you see that? Some people, I think, will never go back. They will probably never go back to a traditional shopping experience in a grocery store if they don't have to. But I'm wondering how much of this is just because of the pandemic and they'll go back when they feel safer. Because that's completely shifted so many different things. Like my Kroger, we have Kroger here in Cincinnati, and most shopping stores have created a whole like system to bring groceries to a car, a whole new parking area, a whole new zone to deliver the groceries. And it's kind of affected the shopping experience for the traditional shoppers and the people that are delivering groceries. That has an impact on perhaps you store groceries. There's a new way to deliver groceries to someone's house so you can deliver like frozen items, right? And I'm curious, once, I don't know if you probably don't know the answer to this, but like how much of this is short-term versus long-term changes?
The easy answer to that is you're right. We don't know the full answer yet. We're certainly monitoring that as we go forward. But my suspicion is a lot of the changes that we've seen so far are permanent, at least to an extent. So I think what the pandemic has done is it's forced a lot of changes that were probably going to happen slowly over time. It's forced them to happen faster. And we all had to adjust very quickly. If you go back, well, it's just over 2 years now. So if you go back 2 years ago, our behaviors then were forced to change quickly. And then we've had 2 years to become, you know, somewhat comfortable with them. So, yeah, I think people are going to go back in stores to the extent that they did before. depends on the category, depends on the retailer, and depends on the, let me call it, the added value benefits of going to that store. So if you're shopping for fresh meat or fresh vegetables, for example, you probably don't want to get those delivered. You're not feeling comfortable. Frozen, as you mentioned, yeah, there are ways of getting frozen foods delivered, but you know, you might not be comfortable with that if you can still go to the store. Some other items, though, whether it's basic cosmetics, whether it's canned goods, whether it's paper products, et cetera, I think we'll see a fundamental shift there, particularly for people who may have, you know, not have access to mobility in the sense they don't own a car. And obviously, we know a lot of people living in urban centers now, you know, may not see the need to purchase a car, for example. So I can go on Amazon and get my dog food or get all most of the products I want and get them delivered tomorrow. So I now don't have to worry about going to my local grocery store and trying to get all my groceries home. They're going to be brought right to my door.
Well, that's the beauty to me is I order a 40-pound bag of dog food and it's on my front porch. I don't have to carry it to my car and the bulky items like that. I feel like I have to start tipping my UPS driver. I'm not sure how to do that. Tip Amazon. Brian, you have a question.
No, mine's actually a bit of a two-part, and it actually segues perfectly into what you just asked. So as we just talked about how there's more people doing the grocery pickups or even having them delivered, how does this impact, one, the kind of the intercepts and research you're doing? How do we account for some of that bias of people if you're doing those in-store intercepts and observations? How are you going to account for those people that are essentially no longer going to be coming into the store? They're going to have those groceries delivered. And I know from just personal, it's a convenience experience. I have neighbors who will never go back. They're like, why will I spend an hour going to the grocery store when I can go online, click what I need, go pick it up, and in 10 minutes I'm home. And now I have 50 minutes now back in my day to go do something else.
Yeah.
Other side of that is, when you talked about that planogram optimization, are you starting to see clients now look to optimize their planogram for those store employee shoppers? So those people who are going out, picking those orders up. I know when I was at Kroger on Sunday, and half the people shopping in there are Kroger employees with the carts doing online order pickup. So are we going to start to see more clients or more stores optimize so those shoppers can get through, so their own shoppers can get through quicker, fulfill more orders, and get more people to pick up items?
Two good questions. Let me answer them backwards, if you don't mind, because I think the best way to look at what we're seeing now is a number of retail outlets that are being turned from a retail store into a mini fulfillment center. So in other words, obviously, there's been a number of stores that didn't make it through the pandemic. There's a fair bit of office real estate that's available. So that, in combination with just some retailers deciding, you know what, I've got a store that didn't quite meet my sales targets before in terms of foot traffic, in terms of the amount of sales it was making. So I'm now going to convert that store in this particularly urban geography. I'm going to convert that store into a mini fulfillment center. And what they're doing within that retail store, within that outlet, is obviously optimizing the mix of products where they are for ease of picking. So to your point, so that the employees can easily pick the items that they're looking for, put those orders together, and then get them shipped out immediately to consumers' homes. So that's absolutely happening, and we're going to see that continue and spread across more and more urban geographies in particular. To answer the first question, which I think was more relating to, what are we doing for planograms for in-store? One of the other biggest changes that we've seen is obviously supply chain dynamics. And the fact that during COVID, where there were restrictions on the number of items that could be produced, that the amount of choice that's actually available in most categories is now reduced relative to what it was 2 years ago. And I think what we're going to find is we're not going to have 27 varieties of vanilla ice cream anymore, for example. We may only have 15 now. So, you know, did the consumer beforehand need 27 varieties? Probably not. And that that challenge of choice, as we like to call it, was a bit of a frustration for a lot of shoppers anyways. Now they don't have as many choices in terms of varieties. They may not have as many choices in terms of available sizes or flavors. Obviously, they still want to be innovative. They still want to come forward with new products. But the opportunity to have as many different items in a store as were available 2 years ago. I don't think you're going to see that come forward anytime soon. So what we're interested in doing, and your original question was, well, how do you account for that bias in terms of intercept interviewing people? I think what we'll find moving forward, and we're already doing this a bit now, is we're pre-recruiting respondents to go on a shopping trip. And part of that pre-recruiting is, how do you shop for this category? So we can be quite interested in, if they're shopping online, that's okay. We want to collect all the information about that experience. And as I say, we can do them in a fully immersive environment, have them shop online, be able to eye track them, be able to monitor exactly what they're looking at, what they're not looking at, what they're paying attention to, or we can take them into a store. So we have the choice by pre-recruiting respondents to in fact put them into the environment that they're used to from a new shopping behavior basis.
I'm fascinated by this. I could ask a lot of questions, and I'm gonna throw one out of left field at you. You work in Toronto and Chicago, and I gotta be careful because I'm outnumbered by Canadians here. And curious, are there big differences between Canadian shoppers and American shoppers other than those ridiculous ketchup potato chips and the weird delicious chocolate that you guys eat?
You missed the delicious going for.
The fundamental change is no. I think obviously each country, each region of the U.S. for that matter, has its choices that they're much more preferable to. I think fundamentally no. The obvious differences between the two countries, pricing tends to be different, packaging tends to be different. So again, in Canada, there is a regulation that packaging has to be bilingual. Now we see some of that in the U.S. obviously in terms of bilingual packaging with Spanish. But it's not a diehard regulation in this country where all packages have to be bilingual. So when you're in Canada, you're looking at a package, both English and French have to receive the same size lettering, for example, which makes it much more challenging to how you design that package to make sure that you're meeting the English and French needs, which is a regulation within the country. Other than that, different retailers. I mean, obviously, Walmart is in both countries and doing very well. Target, as you know, tried to launch into Canada a number of years ago, was not successful, so is no longer there. In the drugstore environment, Walgreens, CVS, large down here in the States. In Canada, it tends to be they're not in Canada. So we have a Shoppers Drug Mart, for example, there, which is a very large chain, which is actually now grown. It was actually owned by the largest retail grocery as well. So different just in terms of where you go shopping. Other than that, quite similar.
Okay. And I interrupted you originally before we went on a nice little tangent there about any other shifts in behavior. Is there anything else you wanted to mention about shifts in behavior? Anything that I cut you off on?
Well, I think there's a couple of other things too. We deal with, a number of other clients in the fast food industry, for example. And the one fundamental thing, and time is going to tell on this one, but we've all become very used to working from home. And the one thing that became extremely evident with work from home, which I think for the most part, people liked. I know obviously our staff has been working from home in our various locations across the US and in Canada, and it's worked out quite well. Obviously we need people in the shopper lab, so they come in when we need them in the shopper lab for sure. But the work from home has had a fundamental impact on the way we drive to work, the way we go to lunch, the way we drive home from work. So we've seen a dramatic impact on, some of the fast food outlets that would be selling coffee and donuts in the morning, for example, or where people go out for lunch and socialize in the office, or how they drive home and their ability to pick things up. Well, if you're working from home, none of those things apply. So now as more and more workplaces are opening up again, we'll see how that shifts back to where it was before. And I think you're still going to have a bit of a hybrid model there. There's going to be some people who are at least working from home for part of the week, which obviously has a large impact on all those retailers or fast food in particular that relied on that, sort of drive traffic every day. Convenience stores would be another perfect example of that. And then just lastly, I think where we've seen quite a few changes is in packaging waste. So obviously the average consumer is much more interested in the environmental side of things, particularly as we've had the weird weather that we've collectively had across North America over the last few years. So packaging waste is a challenge. You know, the manufacturers are really being tasked with, you know, what can we do to reduce packaging? What can we do to make sure we're using recycled packaging? What can we do to cut down, just cut down on the average waste, whether that's coffee cup lids or straws or any, just about any package has to be packaged. And how do we make that more consumer environmentally friendly? And sourcing local, I think it would be another thing too. We're seeing a big trend towards, you know, particularly after the pandemic, how do I get things closer to home? Do I have to rely on getting everything from the Far East? Can I get it from closer to home, whether that's, organic strawberries or whether that's just items that are manufactured here in the U.S. as opposed to some other country on the other side of the world? So that's definitely happening too.
I find it interesting, and I noticed this early on in the pandemic, that we started making sacrifices pretty quickly on the environmental side for safety reasons, right? We had a lot of things much more individually packaged and safer. And I'm curious how fast
disposable.
That'll shift. Yeah, disposable. Yeah,
disposable,
how fast yeah. that'll kind of shift back. That's just kind of an interesting topic to me, is how fast we went from, we were really going really fast, really far down this environmental path. And everybody agrees with that, right? And then all of a sudden, COVID hits, and it's like, well, I kind of want my own disposable. I want my own thing, and I don't want it touching anything else. And
you can't use the reusable bags at the grocery store. You have to use the disposable ones. That's shifting back too.
Time will tell is, I think, the easy answer on that. I think the environment was raised to such a high level of awareness. And obviously we're seeing some of the implications in terms of weather patterns, et cetera. So it has slowed down for sure, but it hasn't gone away. And I think what it's doing is forcing a lot of companies in just about every industry to think of new ways of doing things and to really ask, do we need plastic straws? Do we need plastic cup lids? Do we need all that super packaging that we have on this particular product? And I think that trend will continue, because for the other side of it too, it is an opportunity in many cases to try and reduce the cost of the packaging element for a lot of products. And particularly now with supply chain costs going up, with labor costs going up, manufacturers and retailers are looking for ways to, be able to reduce their costs to offset some of these other increases that are taking place. Part of it driven by the pandemic, obviously, in terms of supply chain. But there's a whole bunch of factors. I mean, we now, for instance, I mentioned convenience before. Pricing is obviously a very important factor as well. And now for the first time in a generation, we're seeing inflation in the U.S. and in Canada and many other jurisdictions around the world. We haven't seen inflation like we're seeing now for, 25 years. So there's a whole group of people that have never grown up and had to deal with inflation. Well, guess what? In the U.S. now, it's about 7.5%, and Canada slightly less, but we're watching our gas prices go up. We're watching all of the factor inputs into the items we're buying going up in cost. So we're very aware of that now.
Okay. That was fascinating.
I agree.
I could talk to you for a long time, Chris, but for the sake of time, let's move on to some, let's get to know you a little bit. We took the marketing mix, 4 P's, and we try to get to know people by mixing it up a little bit. First P is perform. What is something most people don't know about you? Do you have a hidden talent?
I'm not sure if I have a hidden talent or not, but the one thing is that really has, again, this sort of segues into some extent with the pandemic as well. I've always tried to be, athletic. I've always tried to get out there and be active. And so, my hidden talent, or at least my internal hidden talent, I think, is I've become a pickleball fanatic. So if you're familiar at all with the game of pickleball, that is something that segued quite well from the pandemic, because it forced me to go outside and play pickleball when I could, as opposed to going to the gym. Or in the old days, I used to play a lot of squash as well as another sport. Well, obviously playing squash in a little box in the middle of a pandemic probably isn't a good idea. So it forced me to become a lot more serious about playing pickleball, and I've really enjoyed that. And I'd actually call myself a pickleball fanatic now.
Nice. Next question, pandemic. What is something fun or quirky that you started doing during the quarantine? I will mention the shout out to the Mellow Yellow team, who are the 2021 marble racing champions on Yellow's marble racing that I got addicted to in 2020. My Orangers, that's my favorite team. They last won in 2017, so I'm looking for a big 2022 run from them. That's my quirk, obviously. Chris, do you have any quirks or anything other than, I wouldn't consider pickleball a quirk, but if you...
Well, it is a bit of a quirk, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, so two things I would say to that. One is, as I mentioned before, I've always tried to be an active individual, you know, for ever since I can remember. Certainly the pandemic has made me want to make sure that I continue with that, to make sure that I'm active every day. And I literally keep track of what I do every day, not so much from an eating perspective, but certainly from an exercise perspective. So I can literally go back to March 13th, 2 years ago, and tell you what I've done every day. And I'm happy to report that over that 2 year period, I have done something every day. And I force myself, even if it's 11 o'clock at night, I'll go and do something to get it in before midnight. So that's number one. Number two, like a lot of people, my wife and I became, COVID puppy owners during the beginning of the pandemic. So I have a great little dog at home who keeps me active and keeps me going out for walks and things. And we're able to pick him up early in the, early in the first year of the pandemic. And so that's been great in terms of, you know, hey, A, having another companion, but B, someone that, likes going out for walks and likes running around in the backyard and really wants some attention. So that's been great.
Yeah, well, start of the pandemic, no dog, and now your dog is an adult out of the puppy stage. That's how long we've been doing this.
Yeah, it's been quite the ride.
Next P, pampering. Do you have any top indulgences?
Pampering, yeah, I would say, here's another one as it relates to the pandemic. My wife and I have always very much liked the sort of the all-inclusive getaway to the Caribbean, the trips where you just sort of show up and you're pampered the whole time you're there. So we've done a lot of those trips over the years. And believe it or not, I had a trip booked to an all-inclusive destination in Jamaica for the beginning of April 2 years ago. So I was looking forward to going to Negril for the first time. And lo and behold, guess what? We couldn't fly. So that trip had to very easily be canceled. But yeah, the easy answer is, you know, love to be able to get away, sit on a beach, be pampered, and be able to do that, one or two times a year, ideally. And I'm happy to report that now, as things are opening up again, that we should be able to hopefully start thinking about doing that again.
Last P, pastime. What do you do when you have some free time? Working out sounds like a lot of free time.
That's exactly. And as I mentioned, I think a lot of these segue together, which is good. Working out. I think the pandemic, as much as I was active before, as I said, I think the pandemic has forced me to say, I need to make sure I do everything, I do something every day, whether that's going for a walk with the dog, whether that's playing pickleball, whether that's whatever that activity happens to be. I want to make sure I'm getting at least 30 minutes of good exercise in every day. And as I mentioned, I'm happy to report that I've done that for the last 750 days or however long I've been tracking it. It's forcing me to, I don't want to have that day come up that forces me off that track. So unless I'm sick in bed and can't move, I'm going to keep doing something every day just to keep that up.
Impressive. And, I'll close with how can people reach you, but you're clearly an expert in this space. We threw a bunch of questions at that you weren't prepared for, I don't think, and you answered them really well. So you're clearly an expert in shopper research. And so how can people find you?
No, yeah, great questions, great discussion. Very much enjoyed it. I think one thing that if people are interested in learning more about Explorer Research or my background as well, You can visit explorerresearch.com, just as it sounds, two R's in the middle, explorerresearch.com. There's a wealth of information. We update our website certainly weekly, if not daily, with the latest information. We have a blog on there. We have articles of interest, whether that's on VR, whether it's on the metaverse, which is obviously a new technology that's coming in front of everybody. And there's lots of background information in there that you can use as a client or an interested party to find out more about how we operate, the types of things we do, the clients we work with, et cetera. It really is a great resource. And then apart from that, one of my partners, Ann Stevenson, will be a presenter at the upcoming IIEX North America conference in Austin, Texas. So if you happen to be going to that conference or have an interest, you can catch her presentation on the April 19th in Austin, or it'll be live online, I'm sure, as well.
I will be there. A couple of others of us from our company will be in Austin. It's one of my favorite conferences of the year.
Yeah, it's clear. It's nice to see it coming back. That, I mean, it really, we've avoided, like everything else, we've avoided live conferences for the last 2 years, as most people have. So it's exciting to see that this year's conference is back in Austin, and looks like it will be very successful based on the presenters, as well as the number of people that are going to be attending.
All right, Chris, thank you so much. Very informative. I love the discussion, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot.
You. Thanks, Brian.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.